Which is a more likely reunion, Vinny? Mauricio Pochettino and Tottenham or Vinny Perth and Dundalk?
There was the setup. I see it.
OTB AM. Weekdays from 7:30 AM. Listen on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network with Get Set Go. Are you ready for quick start car insurance? Get a quote today at getsetgo.ie.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Only the cream of the crop pick up Champions League medals. Jonathan Greening's got one. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now then, you're welcome along to the football show. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent is with me. Hello.
Hi, Joe.
Lots going on. Real Madrid, Carlo Ancelotti, that one came out of nowhere. It's not our top story this evening as such, but it is pretty extraordinary. Just 18 months in the job at Everton. He was earning, by the way, a very tidy 11 million sterling a year, Carlo. They were paying for him.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, was he in the top three managers in the world? Certainly when he, you know, in terms of pay, when he started there anyway. I'm not sure if that remained the case until now, because there's been a lot of chopping and changing of managers in that period. But yeah, a little bit out of left field, all right, because... I don't know. It sort of seemed like I know they like Everton in a way. Like a lot of clubs this season could have probably qualified for the Champions League. You know, like they would have had probably regrets that they could have been a lot closer to it. But it sort of felt like they were maybe going somewhere. So back to the drawing board for them. Although at least listen, they've got money to play with, presumably. Anyway,
I would have thought so. Hey, you say they were going somewhere. So about 10 days ago, Carlo was asked, "You're not thinking of leaving, by the way, are you, this Real Madrid link?" He says, "Oh no, it's good publicity for me to be linked with Real Madrid, but it's not true. I'm happy to stay here. We have difficulties, of course, but I feel good at Everton. My target is to make Everton better, and every year better," he said, as he headed off for his summer holidays.
Yeah, well, I mean, there you go. We might talk about press conferences later on. Yeah. You know, sometimes those quotes can, you know, they can stick around. They can come back and haunt you in a way, but listen, I don't know, like it's probably hard to turn down Madrid though, isn't it? You know, with whatever they offer.
I mean, it feels like almost a holding pattern in a way. It's a very Real Madrid appointment, 61 years of age. It's almost a Florentino going through top of head solutions. Get me somebody, you know, get me some footballing royalty. You can spare me the latest wonder kid from the Bundesliga. Get me Carlo. You know, it's that kind of a thing, and we'll see how it goes, I guess.
Steady pair of hands, you know. He's been to clubs. You know, his time at Chelsea is sort of remembered as one of the more stable periods, right? You know, I mean, I know he's been to a lot of different places and had mixed luck in them, but I know exactly what you're saying about where Madrid are at the moment. It seems to tie in with that.
Three managers have won three Champions Leagues. He's one of them. So in fairness, he knows what he's doing, to be fair. He can manage upwards in a way that, like Conte at Real Madrid, would be a disaster and blow up after about 2 months. Carlo will go in there and keep things ticking along okay.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, from his perspective, listen, there's obviously finance and prestige and stuff. Like, I mean, he can win a league next season, you know, very easily. Mm. You know, with Everton, what are you striving to achieve? Probably getting into that. As much as I said, they could have had chances this season. That's because it was a bit of a mad old season. Mm. You would sort of think in a normal season, getting into the top four is probably beyond them, even if they have a very good year, you know, and that's obviously a different brief.
Well, so that was one bit of news. The England squad being another piece of news. Happy to say former England international Phil Thompson is with us. I presume from Merseyside, you're saying goodbye to Carlo as well, Phil?
Well, yeah, it was a bit of a surprise, as you just said. You know, Evertonians have absolutely lauded it for quite a while, getting such a manager of high quality. But I think you just said the salary, what he was getting at Everton, obviously was very nice. But it's like with a lot of players, Real Madrid come, he's been there before and he's gone back. I just look at him, I think Everton is a project. Everton's probably 3, 4, 5 years that you've got to work at this thing. And has he really got that time? But then you can say, well, Real Madrid are in a similar position. But I think they're a bit more stable. I think they needed a real safe pair of hands after Zidane. And they don't come more safe. Wonderful man, great sort of football history about him. And it's a lot of Evertonians, though, will be very, very disappointed in him.
Mm. Well, we want to talk to you about the England squad. So it was named today. Mason Greenwood had pulled out injured. And then the unlucky six cut from the 33 squad were Lingard, Ward-Prowse, Ollie Watkins, And then probably no surprises, the uncapped trio of Ramsdale, Ben Godfrey and Ben White. So all the talk of Kyle Walker, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Reece James, Kieran Trippier, what's he going to do? How's he going to work this? Who's he going to leave out? He decided I'm not going to give myself that problem. Four right backs in a squad. He can talk versatility all he wants, but it's still four right backs in a squad.
Yeah, it is four right backs. I looked at this long and hard, and I think what an important one in this is obviously Godfrey and White, centre backs, but he picks Connor Cody, who's a specialist. I know they changed it at Wolves, but he's a specialist at three at the back. Mm. Now, his inclusion says to me that Southgate is trying to be very, very flexible. And with that being very flexible, I think comes to play with the likes of Trent Alexander playing a right wing back. Kyle Walker can play one of the centre backs if Maguire doesn't make it and he's not fit enough. There's a whole host of things which come into play there. As with Reece James, who had a sensational Champions League final. But you just, it was no surprise to me seeing that. And Southgate has let it be known. I don't know whether you've seen the news on Sky, and I'm saying, well, I don't know where the problem was. You know, I had a chat with Trent 3 weeks ago and, you know, said there wasn't really any problems. But it didn't seem that way. Mm. You know, you've seen Trent's performances after being left out of the last squad rose dramatically after he was omitted from that. Now, please don't tell me Southgate was clever enough to leave him out to get that some sort of response. I think it's a great blend, this England team.
Do you? Yeah, because the received wisdom or the sense is that if Maguire is out, Southgate's not as keen on a flat four in that instance.
No, and I think that is. I think he plays a large part in this, does Harry Maguire. I think he is the kingpin at the back, the most experienced one. I'm a great liker of Harry Maguire, and I think a lot depends on his fitness. Will he actually make it? The warm-up games, he won't make, I'm quite sure. He will give him as much time as he can to try and make that first game. So it'll be really interesting what he goes for. And that's why I think the Connor Cody one is gives you a decent idea that he wanted to be flexible and he would be there. He could play Mings one side and Stones the other if Maguire doesn't make it. Or he could use Kyle Walker as one of them. So there's all sorts of problems. But this is a young, I think, fantastic looking England squad.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much talent. We're looking on with envy at this generation of attacking players which has come through as well. And even defensively, a lot of great names there. Who's ahead between Chilwell and Luke Shaw, by the way? I'm not always watching England. Or would that depend on whether it's a five or a four?
I would think both ways. I would think, you know what was quite interesting, guys? Did you see the numbers what the players were all given?
No.
It was like, I think it was like Walker was given number three. Walker was given two. Shaw was given three. It's like, I think Stones was four. Maguire was five.
Right.
It all started to pan out as though that was looking like a team.
Yeah.
But then I went, wow, because young Phil Foden was number 20. And okay. I would like to think he has done enough to be a starter in this team. But there's so much talent, young, vibrant talent that it could be. And the way this is blending with a team now who can keep a ball, guys, for so long, England have been up and at them. Let's do this the British way. And we've never can keep a ball. This team, these youngsters have been brought up this way. And you'll see a very, very different. I'm looking at Qatar when these will be even better.
Yeah, I mean, Phil, it is striking looking at the squad list. And I know it's just sort of a stylistic thing how it was listed, you know, that there was the five midfielders, but then like the eight forward players, you know, and Joe referenced there the array of talent. And I'm just wondering how you see it all sort of panning out in terms of the structure on the pitch. And I appreciate the back three debate and all of that can maybe have a knock-on effect further on up the pitch. But Like, for example, and it's probably someone we're interested in here because he used to wear green, but where does Grealish fit in for you? You know, because there's so many players who can operate maybe in his favourite position, but do you find room for Grealish in your team?
You know, something that it depends on the games. I think the Croatia one and the Scotland one, actually the three games that they start with, you can see him playing these teams. I can see England having a lot of the ball. I know Croatia is a good outfit, but I think this team, we can really sort of play well. I think Declan Rice, who again plays a prominent part in what we're talking about with Grealish jumping ship. But I do think there's room for these players, for these Mavericks. I just love Jack Grealish. I hope my football club is very much got the hat in the ring for this guy if he does think of moving. Well, Phil Foden as well. Mm. You have to find... You look at Rice being in there and then work a team around sort of Declan Rice. You can have one more attacking one alongside him, then a three, then Harry Kane up front. There's so many permutations, but I would, if Jack Grealish is fully fit, we'll see in the warm-up games. He makes things happen. He's one of those guys, the Gascoigne guy, who can get the ball 30 yards from goal, drive past somebody, draw free kicks, or create something. He has got that little bit of magic, but there's so many in that side. You know, young Saka as well can do things like that.
I know, it is amazing. And like, so you have a player like Foden, suddenly you have Grealish, Mason Mount feels like he has to play on recent form, I would think. I mean, there was a time not so long ago when Raheem Sterling would have been kind of automatic starter, and now his form has maybe ebbed away a touch. I mean, how do you fit all these in? So we keep asking you, is he in? Why don't you give us, say he was going five at the back, say Maguire doesn't quite make it. Give us some kind of combination of what you'd like to see and what you think he might do. Meet Southgate halfway there.
I would like to still think he would go four at the back. And with my Liverpool head on, I would go with Trent.
Okay.
Being in there, I would go with Stones and probably Mings if Maguire doesn't make it. And then I would play Declan Rice. Will Jordan Henderson played enough games? That's why I'm thinking for these games, Declan Rice would make some mount alongside him. And then you can have those flair players just behind Harry Kane, obviously, up front. Then you can have Grealish, you can have Foden, and then you can have Rashford. So I think you've got some great stuff in there. And that obviously omits Raheem Sterling, who I was actually shocked that he played in the final after him being missing, being left out of the team for so long. To bring him back in that game, I was amazed. I really was.
Sort of a... probably a difficult question to answer, but you know, I cannot.
The one that you've just asked me about.
Well, yeah, well, that was easy compared to this one. You know, I sort of vividly remember, you know, when Germany won the World Cup not so long ago, reading pieces about how, you know, post Euro 2000, they had decided to tear everything up and they were going to, you know, come again and sort of everything out at youth level, and reading all these pieces about how they had done that in a very structural way. Like with England, I mean, you think of 0-2 and like the flat four and not keeping the ball, and that continued for a long time up until pretty recently. It definitely felt, even in the like early 2000s, like an English team would just never go to a tournament and be a possession-based team or be a technical team or, you know, develop these kind of players. It just seemed like Fodens were not going to be English players. Of course, you know, ridiculous really, but it just kind of felt that way. Did the FA deserve some credit here? Did they put some kind of plan in action that we'll be reading about in a couple of years if England go and win the World Cup sometime? Or is it just a golden generation? Or could you put your finger on it?
It's a Dutch generation. It's the German generation. It's the Spanish generation. And I think sometimes you get to that point. I remember speaking to Didi Hamann back in those early 2000s, and he went, "Tom, I was saying, what has Germany got, you know, coming through?" He said, "Phil, we have to rip it all up and start again." He said, "We are so struggling for young talent." He said, "We've not got a lot to go to." He says, "We are literally starting again."
Yeah.
And you could see this evolving with that German team. And I think England have done it quite a few years ago. And you've seen in those younger age groups, a pattern started to emerge. They started not just to play possession-based football. He was still had this little bit of sort of passion for the game. But you've seen it developing that we were it, and we were winning trophies at the younger age group. Now, you can't just disregard that. Something was stirring. And I'd like to think you see these lads coming through here now. And it does, you know, your Trent Alexander-Arnold, your Chilwell, you know, there's great players, particularly your Foden. And I know Grealish was one of your guys, but we've got Rashford and Sterling and Saka. You just see these lads coming through the younger teams and filling it. And the football clubs, what a lot of these teams play for now are possession-based teams. Guardiola coming in, Klopp coming in, high press, possession-based. And we're seeing, and it's benefiting a lot of these. I think they said it was the most English players that we've had coming to the last weekend of the season, the most English players playing in the top flight, which speaks volumes for it, particularly when you look at the Champions League final, playing at that level, how many English players were there?
Yeah. No, it's amazing because, like, it was just a head-scratcher for a long time, even, like, as late as the 06 World Cup. You'd be watching the midfield of Beckham, Gerrard, Lampard,
maybe. The golden generation.
Yeah, but, like, like, Trinidad had more possession than them, and they were resorted to lumping it up to Crouch to try and nick a goal. It just didn't make sense. It was very odd for a few years there, English football.
No, absolutely, and it was. It was the golden generation, and we were all thinking, oh, why isn't this working?
Yeah.
As though there was an expectancy of, well, these players are just good players. Let them go out there and it will work. And it is, I think things like that, what happened then, we've gone. Now, even some of these sort of the African teams, the Asian teams were all developing this keep ball. And they had to go back sort of to sort of strip it right down, all these teams. And they did. You could see the technical ability of a lot of players as well. And it proved very hard for England. You know, chasing the ball is not a good way of playing football.
Hmm. I mean, Joe, I was just going to come in on that because I actually was reading yesterday about this elite player performance plan that they introduced in 2012 in England, which does seem to be credited as having some kind of factor in it. And there's a lot of detail in it just to do with, you know, increased sort of number of tournaments at like underage, like really underage level. This thing called bio-banding to avoid the kids born earlier in the year, like the strongest sort of thriving across that. But what seems to come true, and I sort of throw to Phil on it, it's that the Premier League has incredible wealth and always has, you know, throughout its sort of history. But it seems like at a point in the road, they did actually commit to sort of spending really at a really high level on the academies, the category of the academies, and it seems like they reached a point now where you see players like Trent Alexander-Arnold and Foden, that the super clubs are now producing their own player, which was something like, remember for years Chelsea's pursuit to try and produce players through their own academy, and they didn't necessarily, because they would populate the academy with loads of players from other countries at 15, 16, 17. And I don't know, Phil, you're seeing stuff on the ground over there, but it appears that they've got the balance right now in some respects.
Yeah, there is, because you've seen it. I said for many years that, you know, at Manchester City, at Chelsea, slam the doors on the academies because it wasn't working. And Chelsea would go and say, oh, well, this is our blueprint. This is what we're tending to do. And they all go out on loan. They had something like 40 players out on loan before the start of the season. But that was a plan. But what was seen to involve Chelsea and Manchester City at youth level, they seem to be at the top of the tree all the time. The FA Youth Cup is one or the other. I know Aston Villa and Liverpool have just competed for it. But you see at the super clubs, the under 23 teams and the under 18 teams, Man City, Chelsea are always at the top. So, and you look at them, yes, they're still recruiting overseas players, but we're seeing more and more. I see at Liverpool's academy the number of English boys who are all getting chances now at academies, whereas Manchester City for a long time, you couldn't see. I couldn't see a way in for Phil Foden. It seemed as though, yeah, he's good. And, oh, yeah, I trust him. He'll never get in a game. And you're going, this boy has talent. Guardiola will be saying, well, look at him now. I've done the business with John Stones, and he's come through. But we've seen now our academies bearing fruit. We've got a good blend of the foreign players who get brought in and the English players who are coming. And I don't just mean the local talent. Like at Liverpool, we'll have Liverpool kids. We'll sort of take kids from other academies, as do Man City, Man United, Chelsea, Arsenal. And if they don't want them, we can make use of them. And it's proven quite a success when you see all these young lads and how they're developing now.
No, it really has. We're delighted for you.
Yeah.
So Austria,
you nurtured them. You nurtured them. Rice and Grealish.
Don't. We've talked about this too many times over here, trust me. So Austria Wednesday, Romania Sunday at the Riverside Stadium. And then, like, it's mad. It's suddenly here. Talking about this tournament for so long, June 11th. So what, in 12 days' time, Croatia is the opening game. All the matches will be at Wembley, if people hadn't realised. England's matches will be at Wembley, group stages and knockouts right through to the final. So that's a big advantage.
Not the quarterfinals, Joe. Not the quarterfinals.
Oh, sorry. Not the quarters.
Where is that one?
That one, if England win their group and win their round of 16, they go to Rome for the quarterfinals.
Right.
That's the one exception.
Yeah, but isn't that where they could play Germany, France, or Portugal?
It's the round of 16. The round of 16 is the one for England. England are paired with that group F. So if England can runner up in their group, it's the Germany, France, Portugal group. Yeah. So that's round of 16 is going to be tough. Yeah,
I was on the other day with Manu Petit, the Arsenal great, and he was tipping Hungary. Well, Hungary's in that same group as those three teams. How? Why? And he said, "Oh, there's just something that." And I went, "Oh, I give up."
Right. So, well, in that context, and thanks for the correction, Dan, I hadn't actually realised that. So, one game in Rome. In that context, that round of 16 then is going to be tricky for Southgate. In terms of, you know, him keeping the job and you know, everybody being happy with the sense of progress, and you're the man to lead us to Qatar. Yeah. Where what's an acceptable result here? What does he have to do? What's the consensus over there on Southgate?
Even with that tough game, that there's a big potential of getting a really big team, unless it's Hungary. I think that he has to make the semi-finals. Okay. I said earlier on in this conversation, to me, I'm really looking. Yes, we've got a chance at this tournament because not only we are good and we have certainly developed, but there's so many games on home soil. That has to happen, as we've seen in 96 and certainly in 66. But this team hopefully will develop, and I think will be one of the star attractions of Qatar. I really do. And that's what we will be looking, but it's semi-finals or bust, I think, for Gareth Southgate.
And how do you assess the job he's done thus far, Southgate?
I think he's done very, very well. At the last World Cup, we went there for the first time for a long time. The expectation was so low, we didn't think. And my God, how we seen some characters, some good football, and he's developed a great group of players. I think he's done an absolutely sterling job. I really do. And he's got a good manner. He's a proper FA man. But I think there's a bit of toughness behind that face of his.
Yeah, I guess there would have to be. And it was the last World Cup. It's hard to keep track of the years where he was fostering this relationship with the media and like having them in playing darts matches and trying to almost take a bit of the pressure off the players. And that was his approach at the tournament 3 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and I think it worked. I think it helps when you get good press. And I think you've got to have a different strategy. For too long, a a lot of the staff seemed to keep everybody at bay. I think it was Roy Hodgson who wouldn't let anybody get anywhere near the squad, keep them away. And it was awful. Sometimes you're listening to the same voices all the time. And I know there's not a lot of trust with the media anymore, with the players, but sometimes you have to break away. You have to be a bit more relaxed, and the players can perform as they did at the World Cup.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Phil Thompson, thanks, Phil.
My pleasure, guys. My pleasure.
Cheers. We'll take a short break, and then, Dan, a few things for us to talk about. Ireland do have a game in 2 days' time against Andorra. And I know on the back of the Naomi Osaka conversation, which is kind of everywhere at the moment, we were going to chat a little bit about football press conferences, and be interested to get your take on that. You've been in lots of them. So back in just a moment.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Only the cream of the crop pick up Champions League medals. Jonathan Greening's got one. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
I was just glancing back down at the England team that played Croatia in the World Cup semi-final in 18. So we had Pickford in goal. We had a back five of Trippier, Walker, Stones, Maguire. That could all survive, with Ashley Young at left back then. So they probably improved on Young, you would have to say, be it Chilwell or Shaw. The midfield, Henderson, Lingard, Dele Alli. Well, they've improved on that, I think you'd have to say. And up front, it was Sterling and Kane. And then on the bench, they had Rose, Dyer, Vardy, all gone now. Rashford was on the bench as well. So that was them in 2018. And like the squad now, if anyone didn't see the whole squad, Pickford, Sam Johnstone, Dean Henderson, the goalkeepers, defenders. We have our four right backs, Reece James, Kyle Walker, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Kieran Trippier. Then it's Stones, Maguire, Tyrone Mings, Connor Cody, who was mentioned obviously there by Phil as, you know, ideal for a back five. Ben Chilwell, Luke Shaw, both off the back of really good seasons. Midfield, Henderson, Calvin Phillips of Leeds, Declan Rice, 17-year-old Jude Bellingham, we never even mentioned him. And then Mason Mount, Jack Grealish into the forwards, Phil Foden, Bukayo Saka, Jadon Sancho, Raheem Sterling, Marcus Rashford, Harry Kane, Dominic Calvert-Lewin. I mean,
it's not a bad squad. You mentioned the 2018 World Cup, because I actually remember I was at that game, but prior to that would have been in France watching the World Cup winners play Ireland with Declan Rice playing for Ireland, of course. So we didn't really see what was coming then in terms of, you know, Rice would be a key man for a World Cup protagonist a couple of years later. I'll tell you what, though. I mean, they're lucky in a way, Southgate, that it's 26-man squad because of COVID.
Yeah.
You know, and I see Scotland have had a case today, so it can happen. But obviously, if they're even cutting it to 23, it would be tough with that list, wouldn't you? Like, who would? Okay, maybe someone like Saka might have missed out, and you know, but it's a tough one. One of the right backs, and then it's a bit more of a headline, you know, isn't it?
So, I do vividly remember that Croatia match in particular. The Irish Open was on. I think this was the game. The Irish Open was on in Ballyliffin and Donegal, and it was certainly an England game. I think it was this Croatian game, and like, it's, you know, huge amount of people watching it, having food. And I had sort of been operating under the assumption that we were all kind of rooting for England. And then Perisic scored the equaliser on 68 minutes. And it turned out we definitely weren't all.
I was at most of the England game. I was at all the England knockout games. And I have to admit, like, they played Sweden in the quarterfinals. And it was like, England getting through this would be no issue with that. But then it got to the Croatia game and you were thinking, I'm not so sure, because you were like, France Belgium was the other semi-final, and you sort of, in a way, you wondered that England have a chance. Like, you know, we can be mature enough to want them to go far, but are we mature enough to want them to win? I mean, that's obviously, like, you know, the question that we face. You know, their interest, them being in the competition for a long time probably prolongs interest levels. But I mean, there comes a point where it was like, it's a good story, this Croatian story, isn't it? It's brilliant for them.
So you were listening to the start of the show, and myself and Richie and Adrian were chatting about the Naomi Osaka situation. And look, that is a very complicated topic, and there are probably minute contradictions in what she initially said about the press conferences and why she didn't like them, to what she said on Monday about why she doesn't like them. Where Monday it's less about the types of questions I'm being asked, which was definitely in her initial statement, and now it's just more huge waves of anxiety and stress at the very thought of doing them. And, you know, it's not even necessarily about the journalists or the questions. So it's quite a nuanced situation there. And I still think in the Osaka case, her talking about it more, you know, ironically, in a space she's kind of comfortable with, it'll be kind of shed more light on what's going on. But you were listening and you kind of said, geez, we should touch on football press conferences. I was even thinking after you texted, like, Pep Guardiola sits down on Saturday night and it's like, so what gives, Pep? You made a mess of this, and why didn't you pick Fernandinho, and what were you thinking? And
yeah,
you know, it's in all sports, not least football.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, it's certainly one that's thought-provoking, because obviously there's been a couple of pieces written about, like, you know, what's the point of the press conference then? And like, it is something that a lot of people in media would do a lot of time. You spend a lot of time probably going to press conferences and then complaining, going, well, that was a load of rubbish, wasn't it? But yet, in the same breath, like, we could have been speaking last week, I think it was, or 2 weeks ago, with Alex Ferguson. And one of his big things about Steven Gerrard, wasn't it, was how he carried himself in the press. Mm. You know, that in football, in a way, your press persona is actually very much part of how you do the job. And even, it's not so much the substance of what you say sometimes, but how you sort of comport yourself in that sort of scrutiny and spotlight is almost tied in with the perception of your strength, you know? And it's such a very different thing, isn't it, from the individual sport where, you know, the a lot of those athletes, and we can generalize, and you have to be very careful to generalize, but obviously, you know, the exceptional tennis players, and, you know, even watching the Drive to Survive, the Formula One stars and stuff, and the golfers, as you would know well, it's such an individualized sport that they probably place a lot on their own mental strength. And but there's obviously, there can be a degree of fragility there too, and you can understand how you're exposed to those settings. Like, it can be very difficult, and that's the thing. Like, it's not, you know, a football manager can probably choose to storm out of a press conference and, you know, even not turn up when it suits them. And players in team sports can be protected from it far more than they can. There's not really mandatory press conferences for players in football, you know. So that is the one point where you would have a real sympathy with it, that it doesn't naturally stand. But I actually do think that the idea that the press conferences themselves don't matter, like, I'm not so sure about that. I still think the press conference has a role to play in what we do, and people say we could do without them. I'm not so sure you can. Like, I was just thinking there about the Super League experiment there not so long ago, and what a role all the press engagements that week played in that, and the fact that every manager had to go out and face the media, and there was no hiding place from it. And if you were in a world that was, people say, well, they can communicate through social media, you know, that's how you can manage things. If you had a tightly controlled, club controlled social media environment around stuff like that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that wouldn't be discussed, and we wouldn't get to places and wouldn't get to debates that we need to have, you know. Mm. So it's obviously there's a sort of a nuanced debate with it, you know, and there's a fine line between you have a responsibility to do it and you shouldn't be exposed to it at this particular time. And obviously, in the aftermath of defeat, as always, when someone is at the most vulnerable and emotional, and I think you have to be cognizant of that. But I don't know. Like, I mean,
yeah, and
it's part of the gig, isn't it?
Well, that's certainly been the way it's been for a very long time. Yeah, certainly. And look, it probably is easier in football when you don't have to do it as often as an individual sport, where it's day in, day out. And what about the general tone of questioning in press conferences you're at? I mean, I would find generally pretty respectful.
it can be my sense,
but I'm sure there are exceptions.
Well, it can be. I mean, I've been in a couple of Roy Keane press conferences where, you know, the odd one where it's kicked off. One in particular, I can recall, which was almost a behind closed doors one. You know, there was no cameras and no microphones, and that's the thing. I mean, sometimes when you can be protective of the press conference, but then it's very, the football ones can be smaller, and you know, in the non sort of Zoom times, you know, they can be a bit more private in a way, you know. And I've seen, like, you know, I remember one particular one where Keane was exploding, but he didn't look like someone who was troubled by the concept of press conferences. He looked like someone who was actively relishing it.
Yeah.
You know, and this is obviously where the different personalities come into it. But, like, I mean, yes, there are times where you don't achieve very much and you come out of a press conference going, that was a load of garbage. But it's also, like, it is also sometimes where it becomes part of the scrutiny of someone's ability to handle a particular job or role. You know, that is, well, if someone is a bit rattled today in this press conference, does that mean they may be struggling in this job? And maybe that's more of a manager-player thing. This is the thing. I think for the manager, it probably should always be mandatory. I'm not sure, you know. Whereas obviously for, you know, a player, there's probably two sides to this debate. And there's a big thing of the press conference generally. But I think there are some people, as part of their job, they are spokespeople for the club. You know, and I just think you have to be careful of going down the road too much of saying, well, people can communicate through, you know, their own channels to their fans. Like that, that's just a dangerous road to go down. You know, then there's certain things you don't see happen that should happen. Like you talk about Paul Kimmage asking Lance Armstrong a question many years back. Like there are times where you need this to happen. There are, you know, there are causes like around the Black Lives Matter and around sort of various debates where you need people to be held to account. So there's a balancing act to be found somewhere here. But obviously, you know, it's maybe a case of the mandatory nature of it, you know, that people face in individual sports. I can see that debate, but I think the press conference generally is still part of the circus of sport. It's what sustains us. And, you know, unfortunately, and this is the thing, yes, we all, and it's, you have to be careful about how you phrase it, but like, you know, people hate listening to people talk about the media and sport and all of that, but it is like TV companies and broadcast rights and stuff that generally has a big say in, you know, it does generate a lot of income and revenue that goes into top level professional sports. So there will always be a degree of commitment that comes with that. And I think you just have to find that balance somewhere.
Yeah. So Ireland Andorra on Thursday, they're in the midst of this 10-day camp in northern Catalonia. I didn't quite realize where in Spain they were. So we're 11-0 when it comes to wins. I had a moment.
0-11, is that what the official term in American sports know. Or something?
I don't know. Yeah. I had a moment earlier where, you know, there's just so much going on in the world and your head's fried half the time, and I was like, where are we? What's going on again? Because like the Euros are on. I was like, what month is it? What day is it? Where are Ireland again? And then suddenly it just hit me. Gerson Rodriguez, Luxembourg, Dublin. And then I was like, oh, Mitrovic's lob. Oh God, we're 0-2 in the World Cup qualifiers. It just for a moment, I was like waking up and not quite knowing where I was. And then I suddenly realized World Cup qualification probably beyond us already. And then the sorry stick, because there's been so much talk of 11-0, this big thing, and actually really it's the 2-0 that are kind of the killer. So September 1st, Portugal. You're not going to tell me Andorra have improved like Luxembourg, I presume. We should wallop Andorra, no, should we? Things get very serious if we don't.
But it's, yeah, Phil was talking about Hungary earlier, and Ireland play Hungary next Tuesday, which is like Hungary's warm-up before they go to this major tournament. And that's really when you're going to, you know, it'll bring it home that like this is one team going somewhere, and you know, Ireland are like the warm-up act. But no, in terms of Andorra, no. It's actually, Dundalk would have played one of the top teams in Andorra at the start of their Europa League run last year. The one that, you know, that the great draw they got that brought them into the group stages. And like the Andorran national team has a couple of sort of old timers knocking around who they fritter around between the top teams in Andorra and the lower divisions in Spain. And you know, there is no suggestion that there's been some Andorran elite pathway plan that's been sort of kicking them through. So I mean, to me, like, you know, when I saw this game was arranged, it smacked to me of, I think there's an acknowledgement, yeah, maybe no harm to like not have every, like not playing England away in a friendly, you know, for logistical reasons, probably backfired for a number of different ways. Like Ireland were due to play Bosnia that night and might have been better off going to Bosnia in hindsight, because they ended up getting COVID cases in England anyway. And I think when you have a manager under a bit of fire, and you have a training camp, which is a long spell together, playing a lesser light makes a bit of sense, presuming you go and win the game. Now, from my knowledge, of my limited knowledge of Andorra, they will probably park the bus a bit, and it's a tight old ground and not the best place. So Ireland will need players who will be able to unlock, you know, unlock defences and pick a pass or two.
Oh my God, Dan, everything you're saying here is a disaster.
It's like, I mean, we can see the nil all after 70 minutes in our head here.
What kind of team can Stephen Kenny name here? I know we've seen all the new inductees into the squad, and we've talked about them last week, but in terms of the old stalwarts who are there, I haven't quite seen who's in, who's out. So what kind of an 11 could he go with to, you know?
I'm not sure, actually. Yeah, okay. I need to probably look at that. I mean, I have a sort of a rough awareness of it, but you're a little bit detached from it just not being there, you know? It's obviously very strange not to be around one of these sort of camps as you generally would be. So you're not watching training every day in the way that you would. So I sort of caveat it that way. But the senior players who have travelled, Seamus Coleman is there, but he's not expected to play against Andorra because he's carrying something, possibly not even against Hungary. Shane Duffy is there. James McLean are there in terms of the real old-timers. A lot of the others aren't there. You know, Enda Stevens isn't there. You know, Robbie Brady's not there. Jeff Hendrick, Darren Randolph. So I suppose, and there's a couple of others as well. So in terms of body points of interest for this game, John Egan will be back, who I think is a very important player for Kenny, who he's missed. And has really missed having him in terms of that ball carrier coming out of defence. We're going to see, I would suspect, if he's fit, Quivian Kelleher in goals, who we know a lot about, but we haven't actually seen him play for Ireland yet. Now, the alternative would be Gavin Bazunu, who obviously played in March. So I think you're going to have an interesting option there. And I think then in the other areas of the pitch, it's a bit more like Callum Robinson is out, Aaron Connolly is out. So, but Adam Ida is there, having come back to form at the end of the season, or back to fitness. So I suspect we'll see Ida prominently across the next two games. And in terms of the younger players, I mean, Jason Knight is there, Jason Malumbi is there. But also, I think in the number 10 department, which we touched on last week, there's Jamie McGrath, who's in the squad. He was probably a player for this type of game, I would have thought, from St Mirren. He's one I would expect. There's others. Danny Mandrews in the squad. A new guy from Peterborough, Sammy Smodix. But I think McGrath is one that we will probably see. And Conor Harahan has travelled out after playing in the playoff final for Swansea. And I see he's up doing press tomorrow. So that would suggest he's probably going to play in the game on Thursday too.
Okay. Stephen Kenny was talking to the media over the weekend. I know in the Sunday papers there were various quotes. The theme he seemed to be going for, or the one that was picked up anyway, was about, well, I guess, how we're pitching the next couple of years. And he was saying over the next few years there'll be a really strong cohort of players coming through, and for the next European Championships a lot of them will have 10 or 15 caps under their belt. The Irish public will identify with these players when they're successful. There'll be a great connection, but we do have to start winning matches and take it from there. So it was interesting to see him pitching it in this way, and he's done that a few times over the last while, that this is a period of transition. This is about getting to a point for the next European Championships where we do have a lot of good young players with 10, 15 caps under their belt.
No, definitely. And it's, ultimately for Stephen Kenny, the mission for him now, after the Luxembourg defeat, as much as I think he has a reasonable level of support from the FAI, his mission is to get to that Euros campaign, you know? So he has to do enough in the rest of this year to get his contract extended. So, and it's interesting now we're hearing about, you know, trial events and stuff, and a possibility that comes September for when Ireland, Portugal away, I think there'd be a broader level of understanding if Portugal away is you know, does not end, you know, with a point coming back. But obviously there's two home games in that window that follow, Azerbaijan at home and Serbia at home. And, you know, if you have, say, you know, a quarter full stadium, or, you know, something in the 15,000, 20,000 even territory, if things go well, we will have those theories tested in terms of, do we have a stadium there that is connecting with these young players that are trying to learn on the job, you know, and are showing signs of, yeah, they're trying to play in a different way, or will there be signs of impatience if Ireland are playing Azerbaijan at home and it's repetition from Ireland-Luxembourg in March? And I think, that is going to be a crucial window for Kenny, you know, just that sense of, there comes a point where you need something tangible to go with the statements. I still remain supportive. I think he is undergoing a rebuilding task that would have been difficult for any manager. But obviously you need people to come with you, and they're going to need something, you know, later this year, even particularly in those home games, if there's a crowd in it, just to reassure people that this is going somewhere.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, I never actually asked you about the Champions League final. Do you want to join the army of armchair quarterbacks slamming Pep Guardiola? What does Guardiola know about football?
Ah, listen, I mean, the story wrote itself, didn't it? I heard you in the Sunday pay-per-view talking about the match reports and how difficult it can be, but there was a clear angle delivered by the team selection when it didn't work. Mm. I was just glad that it was an enjoyable game. I had no stake in the game in terms of who won, but I found myself willing for an equaliser so we'd have 30 minutes more, which is generally a good sign because sometimes those all-one-country finals, you know, can be a bit... dull. And listen, it was a very enjoyable game, and it's sort of, you know, in sort of a computer game parlance, you know, if Man City had won that game, they would have completed it. You know, yeah. They would have completed everything. So it's that little kink there that sort of, actually, in a strange way, it makes you more invested in how they approach the Champions League next year.
To what extent would you have certain misgivings about Pep now on the back of the team selection?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, listen, the winners write the history and all of that. I mean, they did have a chance in injury time that if it goes in, like, we would have gone about things in a different way, maybe. But listen, it does appear sometimes the obvious answer is staring you in the face. Like, it does appear like he did try to be too clever with his selection and he got it wrong. And it's something that has happened in the past. And that, you know, the power of City this year has been they've been so good that they haven't always needed to spring a surprise. It seems very simplistic analysis, and you'd like to be able to, you know, to sort of provide something more on top of it. Like, you do have misgivings that clearly, you know, he has a thing in his head probably about City and the Champions League, and this is the one thing that he needs to do to complete this task. And clearly, there's a human frailty there that, you know, he overthought it. That would appear to be the case. You know, it would be interesting in time if staff or people around him who are part of his consultation, you know, maybe in years to come, will discuss like the process and how he felt about it in the aftermath and how he really felt about it, because maybe that obvious answer that we're talking about is the answer that he wrapped himself in knots a bit.
Yeah. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent, thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
Cheers. We'll talk to you in the coming days. Ireland Andorra on Thursday. Football on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Only the cream of the crop pick up Champions League medals. Jonathan Greening's got one. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network with Get Set Go. Are you ready for quick start car insurance? Get a quote today at getsetgo.ie.